Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. This is NPR News. I'm Brant Williams sitting in for Carrie Miller. One of the men charged in the bombing of a Bloomington mosque last August, Michael B. Harry, is the leader of an anti-government militia. NPR News reporter Mukhtar Ibrahim has written more about Harry's militia on nprnews.org. I suggest you go and read some more about that. And last year, the Chicago Tribune reported that Harry's security company made a bid to construct a wall along the country's southern border. The article quotes him saying this, quote, "We would look at the wall as not just a physical barrier to immigration, but also as a symbol of the American determination to defend our culture, our language, our heritage from any outsiders." The FBI says Harry paid two other men to throw an explosive into the Dar al-Farouk Islamic Center last August. One of those men, according to the charges, told the FBI he wanted to scare Muslims out of the country. And that leads us to our discussion this morning. And I'm really interested in looking at the news coverage of white supremacist groups and white nationalists. Particularly, how does the amount and type of coverage of certain racist group or people maybe perhaps emboldens them? Should there be more coverage aimed at undermining the philosophy of white supremacy itself? Of course, I want your calls. Give me a call at 651-227-6000 or toll free at 800-242-2828. My guest for the next half hour or so knows what it's like to interview white supremacists and Nazis. Lois Beckett is a senior reporter for The Guardian US. She's also covered gun policy and politics as well. You may have heard Lois recently guest host the On the Media podcast earlier this month. And during the program, she spoke with other journalists and academics about covering white supremacists and white nationalist groups. Lois, thanks so much for being here this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, I want to first start by, have us listen to just a couple samples of some of the coverage, and then I'm going to ask you some questions about the terms that we're going to be hearing in this montage.
There's a new buzzword that everybody involved in the campaign is suddenly spouting, and it's alt-right.
Young, college-educated, clean-cut, and radicalized. The alt-right movement ready to stand up for white power.
Clinton sought to tie Trump today not to the right, but to the alt-right, a white nationalist movement flourishing online.
The mainstream media is fond of portraying the alt-right as a mob of unruly, racist, bigoted, sexist, uneducated white males who've been unleashed and who feel empowered by Donald Trump's rejection of political correctness.
Lois, when you hear that, what are you thinking? I mean, what are some of these labels that are getting thrown around? And are there terms in there that you think journalists should avoid using?
So I think looking back over the past more than year of coverage, trying to understand how journalists grappled with racist extremists online and their attempts, successful attempts, to link themselves to Trump's rise, there's a couple of things that are important to say. One, I think journalists actually did a pretty good job, the Associated Press, I think, leading the way, at labeling alt-right as something that was a racist ideology, that was a white nationalist ideology at the beginning. We were pretty careful at saying alt-right, you know, it is this sort of intriguing new term, and maybe we're going to give it more coverage than it deserves, but like, let's define what it means and explain just how extreme and how far to the right it is. And I think what gets trickier is, you know, when you see news coverage that spends a lot of time saying these people are white nationalists and they believe that only white people should be in their country, but they don't think that they should be called white supremacists. They think they just should live in an all-white country, but that doesn't mean they hate anybody else of other races, and spending a lot of time sort of debating the finer points. And that is a game that you're playing on these white nationalist territory. It is just incredibly disingenuous to say that, oh, I'm a white nationalist, but I don't hate people of other races. I just think that they're lazy and violent, and I don't want to live with them. That's just a foolish debate to have and a foolish debate to give airtime or space time to in your article.
And as a journalist covering these folks, have you ever been in a situation where somebody's tried to portray themselves in a way and you have had to perhaps check them and say, well, aren't you espousing a type of white supremacy? Have you been in that situation before?
So I think the difficult thing with covering racism in America is that basically no one in America will call themselves a racist. And no matter what they say and what they believe, everyone will say, well, other people are racist. I'm certainly not racist. And these terminological debates are really frustrating. So I have covered a group that identifies themselves as National Socialists, openly identifies with fascism. But when I said, okay, so you're National Socialists, so you're neo-Nazis, they're like, no. That term is a slur. That term was a slur invented by our enemies. Even though I am a National Socialist, it is completely inappropriate to call me a neo-Nazi. And so it's extra work for journalists, as always, but this is, you know, part of the most valuable thing that we do is cut through what people want to be called and their debates over what terms are nice or not, and just say, you know, how do I inform my reader in a frank manner who these people actually are? And if a National Socialist is telling you, please don't call me a neo-Nazi, I think that will bias people against me. That's probably actually the accurate term you should use. We should neo-Nazi carries connotations that are accurate in describing to describing these beliefs and their actions and their level of dangerousness.
Sure, and give me a sense of when you're covering these groups and these people, how conscious are you of that? You may be also fueling or giving more popularity or exposure to these groups.
So I think this is something that all journalists who cover these groups think about a lot. And over the past more than a year that these groups have gotten more media attention, a lot of readers and listeners have been really frustrated by the amount of media coverage and by the fact that these groups are getting covered at all. There are a lot of people out there who just think that, you know, just ignore them and they'll go away, which is a false belief. These groups have been around for, in their modern incarnations, for decades. And even when they don't get a lot of media coverage, they're still out there, they're still recruiting, they're still engaging sometimes in acts of violence. But I think, you know, as journalists, we often lean on this idea that sunshine is the best disinfectant. And if you cover something and expose it, that's a good way of dealing with it. And that may be true in a lot of situations. But I think a lot of the journalists who have done this work all acknowledge that when you're covering conspiracy theorists, extremists of this kind, they really want media coverage. They feel like it legitimizes them, and they feel like it helps them recruit. And, you know, these neo-Nazi leaders have told me and other journalists explicitly, we don't care how negative your article is. We don't care if you don't even use the terms that we like. The fact that we're in the paper means that we're going to be able to use your coverage to recruit. And that's incredibly disturbing and sobering to hear. But at the same time, these are violent groups that are out in public and they're recruiting. And that is a story that we want to cover. But I think a lot of the learning curve for journalists in approaching this subject is becoming more aware of the dangerousness of coverage, and that sometimes coverage isn't sunshine and disinfectant, but it's amplifying radical ideas. And you make a different calculation about when to publish a story or when you think a news article is warranted in a situation, when you understand that every piece of coverage does amplify very dangerous ideas.
And in the newsroom discussions about these, obviously you're going to have editors and other reporters who are discussing how much coverage to give and what type of coverage. I'm curious to know if the discussions you've had, has there been a concerted effort to also include coverage which it includes context about the history, American history of white nationalism, white supremacy, and perhaps adding context to the stories that get covered?
I think context is absolutely the most important. And in talking to a wide range of journalists who have covered this for many different outlets, including Ellie Reeve, who did that Vice documentary on Charlottesville, which I think was, you know, one of the most praised and widely watched pieces of coverage of these groups, it was all have the context of decades of history, going back to neo-Nazi organizing in the 1950s, right after World War II. You know, before I covered this beat, I had no idea that there were neo-Nazis who showed up at Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, trying to protest against that there is a deep history of extremism in this country that hasn't gotten a lot of coverage in recent years because people don't want to think about it, and they don't, especially I think white Americans, don't want to be reminded of the ugliness of this history or want to distance themselves from it. But context is so essential in covering these groups because they're constantly lying and they're constantly trying to portray themselves as new and their tactics as novel, and simply being able to explain that all of this has been done before over and over again, and each time it fails, levels is a crucial piece of information for readers to understand how dangerous, how threatening is this, how new is all of this activism.
And should there be some type of more instruction for journalists as we get trained, we go through trainings and we learn as much as we can in the field. Have you seen any really good ways of training and instructing journalists who should be preparing to cover white supremacists if they're on their way to cover a rally or march, what they should learn?
Well, I think the first thing to realize, and this is a tough realization for a lot of people, is that you want to think that because these are racist extremists, that they're really dumb and that covering them couldn't be that hard. They're just freaks sitting out there. But in fact, a lot of these organizers are incredibly smart and incredibly media savvy. They understand how the media works. They understand the demand for content for news organizations and online news organizations. And they are very adept at weaponizing their own media coverage. And so I think that this mindset of a journalist going in that this is sort of a weird, wacky thing to cover and maybe not serious, it's really wrong. And even though these people believe in conspiracy theories that are absolutely false, they've put an incredible amount of time into debating and honing their arguments. So I think it is very dangerous, for instance, to put a white supremacist in front of a camera and attempt to argue with them if you've never done that before. It's really dangerous in a lot of different ways. So I think one is just realizing that it does take a lot of preparation and it's not like you're going to just be able to tell them a fact and they're going to be like, oh, wow, you're right. Like, I'm not a racist anymore. It's a lot more difficult than that. But I think another thing that has been really striking and a lot of critics of this coverage have highlighted is that American newsrooms are disproportionately white. The reporters and the editors sitting in them are more likely to be white than the cities that they're reporting on. About 40% of Americans are people of color overall in newspaper and online newsrooms. That's about 17%. So a lot of criticism has focused on there's actually a tremendous amount of life experience and perspective that different Americans might have on these groups, and that actually your life experience might either give you a window into understanding how to cover these kinds of extremist groups and how to think about them, or it might actually be a barrier and make you a little bit tone deaf or not understanding the full consequences of the kind of reporting that you're doing.
Well, that's a good point. That's something I want to also include in just in a minute or two. We do have some callers, and I want to get to one of those calls now. And if you're listening and you'd like to call in, 651-227-6000 or toll free at 800-242-2828. I believe we have a caller on line two. Hello, go ahead.
Hi there.
Hi. What's your question?
Hi. Well, I have more of a comment, frankly. I think, from my perspective, it seems to me that the media tends to deal with these organizations kind of with kid gloves, that there's a sort of an effort to not call a thing what it is, which is that these are terrorist organizations. So, frankly, I'd like to see them referred to as such, and even perhaps with the word Christian in front of it, Christian terrorist group, Christian terrorist organization, in addition to calling them white supremacists, more so than referring to them as the alt-right, which I think sort of cleanses what it actually is and removes sort of the violence that's really behind it.
Thank you so much for that comment. Lois, that's something that has come up, especially with this latest case in Bloomington. We had this bombing in a mosque, and these apparently one of the men, as I mentioned in the opening here, is a part of one of these militia groups. We often use these terms, militias and neo-Nazis, but we don't usually hear that word terrorist added to those labels. What's your thought about that?
So there's a lot of people who are pushing to define this kind of racist violence as terrorism. One of the people we interviewed for the segment, Dr. Ibram Kendi, who is the author of Stamped from the Beginning of the Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America, is very strongly pushing to define this as terrorism. And he says that one of the things that journalists and in our public conversation we tend to do is talk about hatred or call these hate groups. as if this was really motivated by personal sentiment of individual people. And he says defining this as racist terrorism is a much more accurate way of depicting how these groups work and their impact on other people, their impact on the Americans around them, which is tremendously important. I think labels and how we use labels are obviously essential. One other thing, though, that's very important is simply documenting how often violence and racist violence follow around as speakers and advocates who like to present their ideas as just ideas or just ideology. Richard Spencer, of course, the white nationalist who is most famous for being punched in the face at Donald Trump's inauguration, does this a lot. He says, oh, I'm being persecuted. These are just ideas. And yet after his rallies, repeatedly after white supremacist rallies, people have engaged in acts of violence. So he went to the University of Florida in the fall, and three of his supporters were charged with murder afterwards for firing a gun at a group of protesters. And yet that fact isn't always recalled, remembered, or included in the coverage of events that have followed him, and so that he's allowed sometimes in the news media to say these are just ideas, and people just leave out the fact that that people who supported him were charged with attempted murder, and that is a really troubling lack of accuracy.
Yeah, and yet we have, you know, if you look at statistics which show the amount of violence committed by these homegrown white supremacist extremist groups, call them terrorist groups, they pose more of a public safety threat than anyone from ISIS or any of these other foreign terrorist groups. It makes me wonder, do you think that newsrooms should devote a beat to covering these types of groups?
So that's a really good question. And I think certainly if you want good coverage of this kind of activity, having a beat reporter assigned to it can be really helpful. One of the things that the editor of the Columbia Journalism Review noted about a year ago in the early debates of covering these groups was that a lot of the problems and the anxiety over the coverage was that the news organizations were presenting this as a new phenomenon and saying, like, suddenly there are these clean-cut racists out there. Like, how much will they transform? And not really contextualizing that a lot of these leaders and these groups had been out there for a long time and doing the same shtick, only this time what was really different was they were beginning to get more attention for it. They had successfully connected their ideas to something happening in the news that they were now newsworthy and they weren't before. That didn't necessarily mean that they were a lot bigger. But I think it's also really important to acknowledge that these fringe groups, while extremely dangerous and violent, are not really the most widespread manifestation of racism in America, and that a lot of quiet, polite racist ideas that are held by large majorities potentially of Americans that inform choices in the criminal justice system, that inform choices in how we fund schools and in the segregation of American schools, they are so impactful. And so if you want to think about, like, how do we cover the impact of racism on Americans, looking at fringe violent groups is only a tiny piece of that. And understanding the broader spread of racist ideas, that's going to be impacting a lot more people.
You know, I'm curious about looking at Richard Spencer, who you just brought up before, and some of the media coverage he's received as being this descriptions of his appearance, that he's this college-looking, erudite, well-spoken. And that kind of coverage was roundly criticized in many circles for almost kind of glamorizing this type of white supremacy. But I'm wondering if there may be a large audience out there who doesn't quite realize that there are people who look like Richard Spencer who have college educations who espouse these views. Is there some service that we can do by providing maybe it's not a effusive description about some of these people, but to keep pointing out that, yeah, these may be people in your neighborhood that you see every day?
So I think that's a really important question. And obviously, this gets back to sort of history and contextualizing these movements and contextualizing what it means to be racist and to be advocating for racist ideas. And so, Yeah, I think it is important to push back against the myth that racism is only something that is a factor for people who are uneducated or people who are poor. Ellie Reeve, who's the vice correspondent, said that after she covered Charlottesville, she was at a party in New York City with a lot of wealthy liberal people, and they kept telling her, oh, it's so sad that these people, you know, that their economic struggling has led them to become racist. And she kept saying, no, that's not the case. I've interviewed a lot of these young men who have become racist extremists. They are actually middle class, upper middle class. They might have gone to private school. They were college educated. That this isn't a problem of a lack of education. This isn't that they're economically anxious. This is that they have been radicalized and they are racists. And she said that was really hard for white liberals to hear, that this wasn't a problem for other people or about other people, that this was a problem that involved them, people exactly like them. And I think that brings us back again to the question of diversity of newsrooms, is that when you're saying, you know, who are the people who might not know what this looks like, what people are you talking about, and which of your readers might, you know, are you talking about white readers or white listeners in particular? And if so, what does it mean to understand that not all of your, you know, not all of our readers, not all of our reporters look the same way or have the same background? And if you have a diverse newsroom talking about different people's perceptions, can you write a piece that is informed, that is written for all of your readers, and that takes into account the perspectives of all of the citizens of your city? And what does that coverage look like, and how's that different?
Exactly. And from the show that you hosted, the On the Media podcast, which is actually one of my favorite podcasts, by the way, and you did a great job covering this topic on there. You know, I was curious about the comments made by Al Letson, who is himself an African-American journalist, talking about and he's interviewed Richard Spencer, and he's like, you know, guys like Richard Spencer, I've dealt with all my life. So Al Letson has a perspective that, you know, is like, look, it's not so surprising to me that people look like Richard Spencer who espouse these types of views. And I'm wondering if there are other things that you think that looking at the newsroom makeup, I mean, if you see a sea change of how these movements are covered, if we had more diverse newsrooms.
I mean, I think that's an argument that a lot of critics made. And what is so frustrating for people in American newsrooms is that editors will always say having diversity, a diverse newsroom is important, and that's something that we value. And they have been saying that for decades. And in the meantime, newsrooms haven't gotten sufficiently diverse. They don't reflect the makeup of the country. The American Society of News Editors pledged back in 1978 that they would have racial parity in newsrooms by 2000, with the explicit understanding that that was what it would take to be more accurate. That was what it would take to really cover the news and to deal with problems exactly like this one in a more sophisticated way, in a way that was more honest to the reality. But editors still won't walk the walk on this issue. They're still not hiring. And just because, and that's a, you know, another conversation and a very difficult one. But I think when we look at this issue and say, wow, newsrooms, you know, really struggled and made some errors here, and don't connect that to a failure to actually follow through on promises that newsrooms and editors have made for decades, you have to weigh that and say, failing to diversify newsrooms, like, this isn't some sort of politically correct thing. This is an issue of whether we're able to fulfill the mandate of our actual jobs, whether we're making mistakes on that. And, you know, there's a cost to failing to follow through on diversity pledges. And I think that's exactly what we're talking about right now.
If you just tuned in, my name's Brant Williams. I'm sitting in for Kerry Miller. And I'm talking this half hour with Lois Beckett. She's a senior reporter at The Guardian US. And we're talking about news coverage of white supremacist groups and rallies and marches and the people who participate in these. And if you have a question or comment, just give me a call, 651-227-6000. Or you can call us toll free at 800-242-2828. And Lois, I'm curious about your experience of, you've gone from covering politics, gun violence, and white supremacists. And I'm curious about how did you wind up covering these folks?
So I have been covering gun politics in the United States for many years. And after the election, as these far right groups were getting more attention, we decided this was an important thing for us to cover, and this project landed on my desk. And I think one of the reasons that I did this project was on the media and wanted to talk to other journalists about it, was because it is was initially disorienting to me as a reporter to say, wow, I'm calling neo-Nazis on a daily basis. This is newsworthy now. But also, I realized that this was a choice that a lot of newsrooms were making, and this was our judgment as to what was important. And we were all making a similar decision at the same time. And so I think that was useful for all of the reporters in this conversation to go back and say, you know, why did we make this judgment call? And was it a good one? And would we do this the same way the next time around? And I think that's, I would just want readers and listeners to know that journalists are being very thoughtful about this. And we had lots of conversations in our own newsroom all the way through from the very beginning of trying not to give these extremist voices a platform, trying to figure out which stories were valuable to tell and which ones we shouldn't tell. And that's something experts have really emphasized, is that strategic silence is an option for newsrooms,
sure.
That covering groups is important. But the choice not to cover them, even if a story might be interesting or colorful, that can be a very valuable choice too.
Thank you. Hey, we've got a caller on the line that I want us to listen to. This is Mary. She's calling from St. Paul.
Hi. Yeah, I've noticed that my son has been influenced by peers, and I think online as well. He was raised in a middle-class, to-the-left home. We've always exposed him to people from different cultures. It was something that was really important to us. And just recently, in the last year or so, I've noticed him spending a lot of time online and making some friends that have these views. And yesterday during the school walkout, he did not participate. And I was chagrined to learn that.
Mm-hmm. And so did you notice what kinds of, does he go to certain websites? Do you notice or does he share certain memes on his social media?
I have not been able to check out his social media anymore. He is on sites that he won't accept me as a friend. Mm. And I would say that some of his comments that he makes seem to be code for this kind of thinking.
Okay.
And it's been a pretty big concern of mine for a while, and I wish there were some resources or some way to kind of deprogram him or
sure.
expose him to some resources that might help him understand the other point of view. Every time he and I
talk Mary,
about
thanks
it,
for
it gets
Oh, Mary, thank you. I want to get Lois and her thoughts on this. Lois, is this something you've heard from other parents of white children who have similar concerns?
I mean, I first want to say that there are a number of organizations that often staffed with people who were part of racist hate groups who work with people who actually have been radicalized and try to transition people back or try to work with people who are part of these groups. So that, you know, if you just look at look online for groups that work with people recovering from hate groups or transitioning out, that is a resource that is available. And of course, you know, from what was shared, we can't make any assumptions about what exactly is going on with a particular person. But I will say, in interviewing young neo-Nazis and young white nationalists, a lot of them say, yeah, my parents have no idea what I'm doing online. I try to give them little hints or sort of push them along the way, and they just don't know that. And this has been something that is incredibly painful for the families that actually experience it, whose children are radicalized and join racist terror groups. And I think, you know, again, we've been talking about this earlier, but I think it's important to that kind of language is important for parents to understand the risks of their children if they are involved in racist extremist groups, that these are groups that are violent, and that's the way that you need to think about it.
Yeah. Hey, Lois, thank you so much for joining me. Of course, we could go on and talk for a lot longer, but we'll let you go. Again, this was Lois Beckett. She's a senior reporter at The Guardian U.S. Again, thanks for joining us.